Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show, where we are with the boy Potter. We are on the run, on the run with me this week is Kanan Flowers. How are you, Kanan?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
And Matt Walden, how are you, sir?
Oh, very good. Thank you.
So we're with the boy Potter, but where are you guys right now as we're recording this?
Well, I am in lovely San Francisco.
You're back in San Fran. Is that now your base?
I believe it is, yeah.
Excellent.
Just pulled together. So basically I have a place to stay now, and all that just got pulled together in the last few hours. So joyful and triumphant. If you have ever lived in San Francisco and you know how hard it is to find a place here, even having a place for a short term is quite a feat.
And Matt, where are you?
I am at home in Keswick, Virginia, just about to wrap up the fall semester at Virginia Commonwealth University in the School of the Arts.
Now, as we're recording, this is the end of your Thanksgiving weekend, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And I know I've asked this before, but I just kind of, what are you giving thanks for exactly again? Is it you're giving thanks for family, kind of culturally, but historically for something else? Is that the idea? No.
No, that's the idea.
That is the idea? Okay. So it's just the Australian ignorance coming through there. I actually organized something for Friday Sydney time, which was Thursday America, completely thinking that Thanksgiving was on a Sunday. And I was corrected by several of my friends who pointed out that was about the dumbest time to organize a meeting in history. Anyway, enough of that. And let's get in on with the show. And we're discussing Harry Potter, which is obviously the seventh film in a series now. I believe, I don't have a cited reference for this, but I believe I was told this was now the most successful franchise in movie history on pure straight dollar terms, outdoing Bond in uncorrected dollars. And obviously not as many films as the Bond films, but we still have one to go to make it a resounding eight. This film split in two. So before we get on with the visual effects, and we're going to discuss this idea of a franchise and the ability to not only maintain assets from film to film, but maintain assets in a collective environment, because this this film in particular is been done and has been done historically by a group of houses, and most recently the London houses. But before we do that, Kanan, let's just get your opinion on the actual film itself. Now, I guess I should ask you first and foremost, had you read the book?
I have not read the book.
Okay. Did it make any sense?
Oh, yeah. It made perfect sense. In fact, from a story perspective or from a filmic perspective, this was my favorite and most epic of the Harry Potter films.
Oh, really?
I like the last one a lot, as you know. From a story perspective and just from a character development and from what I was looking for out of Harry Potter, this was the film that I was hoping for all along, and the one that I got this time.
That's interesting, because I've actually heard people say that if you hadn't read the books, the whole Horcrux thing was nigh on incomprehensible, and that you just kind of didn't know which way was up. Though this film, and we'll discuss this, is somewhat unique in actually having a full-on, what I like to refer to as the 1984 book scene. In other words, the bit where you just stop the film and have some solid exposition. Matt, what did you think of the film, and had you read the books?
Well, I've never read any of the books, but I've seen, I think, all of the movies. Looking back, I'm pretty sure the last two are a little fuzzy for me. But this is probably my second favorite. I really enjoyed the Prisoner of Azkaban, too. That was one that really sticks out in my head. But I did really like this. I was surprised how much I liked it. But there are a couple things that that were a little confusing for me, having not read the book, I think.
Well, Matt, I should fess up that I have read the books. In this particular book, I reread about a month ago on my holidays, because I knew the films would be coming out and I wanted to refresh my memory. My children have read them, and I think my youngest daughter has read the books maybe four or five times each, and she is just loves them to death. I don't know that we would actually classify this as a children's film in any way, shape, or form. It seems like it's become quite adult, but obviously the books are historically children's books, and certainly have appealed to children around the world and got a lot of children reading that otherwise weren't. And I have to say, from a somebody that really has read the books and then, as I say, recently reread them, this is a very faithful recount of the book. And I guess you can do that when you split the film in the book into two films and then have what, two and a half, do you know how long it ran for? It was like, it felt like about over 2 hours, right? 2 hours 20 minutes, I think.
Yeah, two and a half hours.
And so it was very, very faithful. I'm going to, when we discuss some of the characters, point out a couple of things that were missing, not from a, oh God, I wish they'd done that differently, because obviously I know that you can put everything in, but there were a couple of interesting aspects that even the animators themselves wish they'd been able to get to that were in the books that had to be cut. How did you guys see it? I saw it in IMAX, so it was projected very large, but of course this film famously pulled its stereo dimensionalization version. It was going to be done in stereo, and it was going to be done in stereo by dimensionalizing a mono shot film. How did you guys see it projected, Kanan?
I saw it at the Sony Metreon in a format called ETX. ETX is essentially a digital projection. It's about double the size of a standard 35mm screen. So it stands between 35mm and IMAX, but it's a true digital projection with digital sound.
So a good quality projection, I take it.
Oh, finally, yeah. So, you know, I've been harping and complaining about turning projector lights down and things like that. And, man, this was, I was immersed in it for the first time in a very long time. So I was excited about it.
And Matt, how did you see it projected?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question. I saw it in Winchester, Virginia. I was up at my in-laws for the Thanksgiving holiday, and my wife and I snuck away and left our son with Grandma and Grandpa, and we went to I saw a digital projection at what had to be the most amazing cinema-going experience I've had since I was a little kid. I saw it at an Alamo Draft House Theater. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yeah, there's one in Austin. It's fantastic.
It is amazing. If anybody wants to check it out, if you just go to drafthouse.com, it's a series of it's a chain of movie theaters that I believe started in Texas. Is that right, Kanan? Do you know?
Yeah, it started in Austin, Texas. Yep.
Yeah, and it's incredible. It's like no one under 18 is allowed in the theater without an adult, and no one under the age of 6 is allowed in the theater. But you go and you sit in a really nice leather seat with fantastic view, no matter what seat you're in, of the digital projection, great sound. And then there's a small table that runs across the seats in front of you, and all the seats are tiered, sort of stadium style seating, and you can order, I don't know how many beers they had on tap, pints of beer, and a waiter comes and brings them to you during the screening, and they had all kinds of sort of pub style food, and I mean, it was just so much fun. It was such a great, an intelligent way to create a movie going experience for audiences. I mean, it made going to the movies, not just because of the movie itself, but the experience of being at the theater was really fun, and fun in a way that I haven't had at the movies in a long time. I mean, it was just really something.
Well, I have had something similar to that in Australia. There's a Gold kind of event cinema thing that does the same thing. They serve beer and stuff, and I've done it. I know friends of mine that do it a lot. I've done it, not maybe as much as I otherwise would, because I'm a bit of a cheapskate when it comes to spending the extra money, and I have pretty good projection otherwise, but I was impressed with the quality of the IMAX projection. I don't like seeing IMAX unless I'm right up the back, because I just find it too overwhelming. I think I'd be interested to see it again, not IMAX, because it is such a field of view kind of thing that you tend to look around the screen a lot. But I've got to say, at the point at which the snake goes to bite the camera, I ain't seen any snake bigger than that sucker across an IMAX screen. So let's discuss the visual effects and our thoughts on it. This film is different from the films that preceded it, and of course will be very different from the film that will finish the series, in that it's really not based at Hogwarts. It's based on the road as they flee and escape and try and work out a way to defeat the evil Voldemort. Obviously, a spoiler alert, we're going to be pumping in tons of spoilers in this, but I say, as it's faithful to the book, that's really no shocker. Did it feel good to you, Kanan? You said it was the film you were hoping for because there was more character stuff, because they were out of Hogwarts. What was it that you sort of made you like this film, and was it related to the visuals?
Well, my other favorite film, I liked the previous one a lot because of the character development. I liked Prisoner of Azkaban a lot as well. I liked Azkaban because it was so dark, and I'm really into films that have a very dark undercurrent and have a lot of character development. So I liked that aspect of it. a tremendous amount. I mean, that, I thought that was fantastic. You know, I'm reminded a little bit of, I'm sure a lot of people don't like this film, but there was a film called Dune that came out, I guess, in the 80s. And I don't know if you saw it when it came out in the theater, but I remember that, you know, it was a very long film, and there was a 15-minute intermission in that particular film. And so, you know, you watched the first half, and then you had a little 15-minute intermission, and then you came back into the theater, and then you watched the second half. And, of course, I remember half the people leaving, like, oh, this is awful. But I thought a lot about that when I was watching Harry Potter, because I thought that the most frustrating thing about this film is I feel like it could have been a very long and very epic experience with a little bit of an intermission, or it could have all been released at once or what have you. But I felt like they sort of artificially tacked on the second half and are releasing it later in an attempt to garner box office revenue, which, you know, I can't fault them for exactly, but it did, you know, unlike the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know, this felt a lot more sort of artificially constrained, because it did feel like it could have been one much larger film. And so that was, from a development perspective, that was kind of a bummer for me. As far as the visual effects are concerned, though, I have to say I disliked the effects in this film more than I disliked them in many other films. And I'm going to talk about some of that. But the effects did not draw me in the same way that they did in many of the other Harry Potter films.
And so do you want to, is there anything in particular? I mean, where is it this fault lie, do you think?
Well, you know, there's some practical effects that are pretty decent, but there's a couple of scenes. There's a couple of scenes with green screen or with keys that are pulled, and the lighting is horrific. And one of those, for example, is when Hermione and Harry are at the graveyard, and they're looking out into the graveyard, and they see the old woman and that sort of thing. And Hermione has on this sort of cap, right, to protect her from the cold. And the lighting on the cap is—I don't know how it passed QA. I mean, it was badly lit and not keyed very well at all.
Okay. Go on.
Oh, and then I was going to say then the snake, since that was one of the first things we see, Nagini, however you say that, the just didn't work for me at all.
So both in the opening scene on the dining room or the whatever it is boardroom table, and also at the Hollows at the house, where obviously there's the surprise kind of attack. In both cases, you're saying that snake didn't work for you.
Well, it worked far better in the Hollows, in the house, because it was moving much more quickly and it was a lot darker. But on the table, it felt very rubbery, the texture of the snake just did not feel right to me at all. And I don't remember which house did the snake at the very beginning, or I guess in both. Do you happen to know that off the top of your head, Mike?
I don't know the snake off the top of my head, no. I should I'll see if I can look it up while we're talking. Did you like to comment on that, Matt?
Maybe it was NPC, because they did a lot of that work.
Yeah, it says here NPC for the Nagini Voldemort snake.
Which NPC, for those of you who don't know, is Motion Picture Company. They basically are calling themselves NPC now.
Moving Picture Company, I think, isn't it?
Moving Picture. Yeah, there you go. Company. Thank you.
And they've been around for years. I have an old NPC coffee mug for
years ago. I worked for them on Watchmen, too.
Oh, excellent.
I like NPC. I remember when they came out with these coffee mugs. They made these really cool coffee mugs, and they let everybody steal them. And the idea was that it was like a really good way of having PR. And rather than giving stuff away, everyone would just like nick the coffee mugs. Hey, do you want to comment on the snake, Matt?
I didn't have a problem with the snake. I actually really quite enjoyed that opening sequence in the Voldemort. Or I guess they're at what's his nuts, the albino guy's crib, right? And Voldemort's there with the snake, and they're all at the table. And I kept thinking it was a lot like that Brian De Palma scene when Brian De Palma did the his version of The Untouchables with
the baseball bat with
yeah,
De Niro.
Yeah, I kept expecting there to be some really brutal moment. And then, of course, they do pay off at the end with the snake, I guess, devouring the instructor from Hogwarts, who's sort of hovering above the table there for a while. But none of that stuff really stuck out as problematic for me. I think the only stuff, if I was going to point out something that I had a little bit of trouble with, just the visuals of it, and I don't even know if I could put my finger on it per se. Maybe it was just that it was almost too kinetic somehow for me to be able to follow the action. And that would be the bulk of the motorcycle chase that sort of takes place in the sky. And that was something that was just sort of, it was exciting and it was really visceral, but it was kind of hard to, the way I think it, maybe it was boarded or the way in which some of those scenes came together, some of the shots came together. It was almost too fast. Like, and I don't know if maybe I was sitting, I was sort of off a little bit to the side of the screen, which maybe added to some of my my confusion. But it was so frenetic that it was hard to follow the action for me in that scene in particular.
Yeah, I don't think I really had a problem with either of those. So I think certainly the chase scene could have been far more complex, given that you had seven Harrys. If you'd been cutting back and forth to the different journeys of the different Harrys, that would have been insanely complex for the audience to try and decode what was going on. I think the scene was helped by the fact that Hagrid, unlike everybody else, had a very distinctive mode of transport that meant that you could, you know, kind of tell which Harry was the real Harry.
Right.
But again, you know, so hard to know. I knew what was going to happen and sort of knew what was going on. But I know I thought that was kind of interesting, and I thought that going through the cars and the tunnel and stuff was quite effective. I guess my primary observation I'd like to discuss with you guys is more of a positive one, which is very much a positive one. I thought there was – I remember actually sitting in the cinema, and I was sitting next to Ian Fales, who's actually joining us at FX PhD full time now. I'm going to say welcome to Ian.
Right on.
But I was sitting next to Ian, and they had the close-up of Creature and Dobby, and I think at this point it was just Creature. And I remember just saying out loud, wow, because on an IMAX screen and in a slow kind of...
forgive me, is Creature the other elf character, the older...
House, yeah. So there is two. There was one that was freed in the previous films by... Harry assisted in the freeing by getting... Dobby given a sock,
right,
and this
right.
meant that he was given a piece of clothing by somebody who owned him, and that set him free.
Gotcha.
Dobby comes in to assist Creature. Creature is in fact inherited virtually by Harry through a series of events, and up until this point in the books has been quite hostile to Harry, not least of which because he's quite firmly against Hermione and anyone he calls a half-blood, a muggle blood. But the thing about it, I've started down that track. I'll keep going. The thing that was missing from the films in the books is at this particular point when he gets the locket. Of course, there are two lockets. There was one that was substituted in to be a fake and he stole the wrong one, and it all sort of got slightly complicated. But as a result, there was a locket that Harry lets Creature have, which was effectively Creature's previous owner's locket. And because he cherishes this so much, Creature turns 180 degrees from being this kind of nasty, really acidic influence on the three of them to being suddenly tidying up the house, cooking really great meals, being, you know, just everything that you would want, almost like a mother type figure, and making great sticky bun puddings. And, you know, it was just unbelievable how much the character turned around. And as the audience, you just loved this, that he became so incredibly loyal. And both that and the previous stuff that happened with Dobby, of course, sets the emotional undertones for what will happen at what is then the end of this film,
right?
Of course, halfway through the book. But you get a real affection for these house elves that have been undertrodden kind of, and let's face it, kind of annoying at best characters in certain situations. Now, I'm saying wow not because of anything to do with the story. I'm saying wow because I just thought that the subsurface scattering, yeah, skin rendering, and yeah, just general lighting on them, and also in earlier scenes, in earlier films, Dobby was quite frenetic. I mean, he'd come into Harry's bedroom, for example, and Dobby had done something wrong. So Dobby decided to bang his head against a wall or, you know, hit his head in a drawer or something. It was comic relief, but it was frenetic and you didn't really get to linger on the characters. Where in this one, you got those scenes in the kitchen that were really slow. And now, of course, there's the mega death scene at the end, which also is equally, but you'd expect that to be heroically, climactically, you know, whatever. But I'm talking, I guess, about the kitchen scenes because they're just ordinary scenes, but the characters held up so astonishingly well. I just thought that was just immensely interesting. And I thought it was immensely interesting also, and I'm going to talk to you guys about this, about the evolution of assets in large franchises like this. Now, did you guys notice anything different about Dobby and Creature in this film versus earlier films?
I noticed it. I mean, just in the quality and the overall, it looked like the shape of, I don't remember Creature from the previous films, but Dobby for sure. And his face looked different, the shape of his face, and the overall animation, I think was much tighter, sort of in the way you were describing.
Did you notice anything, Kanan?
Well, yeah, I thought that there are, from a story perspective, one thing I realized when I was watching this was that the house elves are extraordinarily powerful magicians. I mean, they're quite good at magic, and they have a tremendous amount of magical powers that I guess they're not allowed to use when they're house elves, but when they're free, they're kind of like Yoda all of a sudden. They bounce around and they're forced to be reckoned with. But from a digital or from an effects perspective, I don't know what they did, but Dobby looked more human. I mean, there's that scene where Harry's holding him on the beach, and I found myself having a very, very strong emotional moment.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I would not have had in a previous movie, right? I mean, like you said, he was sort of blurry and bouncing around and sort of impossible to even care about. But in this one, there was a very human-like quality to his face. Yeah, that I just hadn't seen before.
So the reason I asked that is that we did an interview with Christian Mance over at FX Guide, and it's actually a podcast. There's also some stories on FX Guide. But in that, and I didn't pick this in the cinema. I was just wondering if you guys did. They actually redesigned Creature and Dobby. Dobby's eyes, for example, were smaller, and the proportions of Creature were much more that of an older man. And so the reason I asked you is because I completely agree with you that there was a more human quality to them, and they were emotionally incredibly sympathetic. And, you know, quite frankly, it was a very moving scene. It just point blank worked. But from a technical point of view, I just wanted to discuss it because you have this interesting problem that time goes on, technology moves on. Now, in some respects, let's talk about, say, the Quidditch by way of comparison. Mm. If you look at the early Quidditch work, and I believe, I could be wrong, I apologize if I am, that the early Quidditch work in the earlier films was done by Sony Imageworks. But I remember thinking at the time that the background for the Quidditch seemed relatively simple in the sense that it seemed to be like grass out to a card of where the mountains and trees were, and it really wasn't that spectacular from a technical point of view. In latter films, it increased, but it's almost like, well, the effects weren't as good, now they're better. When you hit characters by comparison, you're kind of locked into the design, and so it's how much you can afford to do that. I mean, how valid is it to redesign the face of a character when it's not an aging thing? It's just that you decide you can, you know, sort of do it better. And I know, I was just curious whether you guys had just sort of sensed that he was actually looking physically different, or whether it's sort of enough time between movies that you just don't care. What do you think, Matt?
I kind of think it's the latter. Like, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense that, you know, in this case, right, Framestore did these guys, and to go back and revisit the design a little bit and rework the character to sort of keep pace with the developments technologically. I don't have any problem with that whatsoever. But I think, you know, for me, I immediately recognized the Dobby character when he appeared on screen, and it was kind of, you know, a fun moment to see that character that I remember from the previous films. And it didn't take me out of the film at all. It wasn't distracting. I mean, I think it's appropriate to do that. I'd be surprised if they didn't. I guess it's sort of the same thing they did in Toy Story 3, when they kind of go back and they rework, Buzz Lightyear and Woody or whatever, and they really kind of get them up to snuff with the current rendering technology, and they rework and rebuild all the models. They don't just dig out the old one that was sort of sitting on the on a disc somewhere, stored away in cold storage. They actually go back and they rebuild it from scratch. And I would be totally surprised if they hadn't done that.
I'm with you on sort of render technology. Like I would normally expect them just to use the best technology they have. And I think this, by the way, all bodes extremely well for the fact that we're going to see digital aging of the hero characters in Film 8. But I don't know. It's just it's a dangerous game. I think they succeeded. In fact, I think Framesource succeeded spectacularly well with this film. But it is a dangerous game to actually redesign, for example, the size of the eyes relative to the head. In a character that's so distinctive. I mean, Creature really looked like an old man much more than he ever did before. I think it was really, really valid to do it. And I've got to say, I spoke to the animators about this, or the team at Framestore, and maybe it's just me, but I begged them to agree with me. It was like, I would have loved to have seen more Creature time. I'd have loved to have seen Creature turn into this guy making sticky pudding and making, Ron's day, and of course that just had to be cut because it was a plot point that didn't significantly go anywhere. So you'd look for those points where it's not furthering the story and cut.
That's interesting though, because it's funny you bring that up. Only in that was the one thing I would say about the overall structure of this film in particular, which was just on one hand, just a side note, there were some amazingly gorgeous and beautiful locations that they shot in, and some of the vistas and some of the cinematography was just absolutely breathtaking. It was really great to watch, but I was sort of surprised how much time, and it didn't bother me at all. I mean, I kind of like that pace, but there was so much time spent kind of hiding out, as it were, right? Like where there was very little action taking place.
In the book, it goes on for chapter after chapter after chapter.
But I wonder, editorially speaking, in the film, like could they, when you talk about the scene, I know you're sort of, being a little bit facetious maybe too, but the idea of seeing some of those scenes with Creature, baking.
I'm not being facetious at all. I'd love to have seen more of them.
I almost wonder if they couldn't have done, some of that and maybe nixed, a minute or two of some of the scenes with Hermione and Harry Potter, where they're kind of just sort of mulling about. Although I do think those were great for character development as well. I mean, but at the same time, I think you could have. I felt like I was starting to get the point,
I think that in the book and in the films, there is just this enormous sense of them lost in the wilderness for a long time. I mean, they're months in the wilderness, just not knowing where they are. And it's only that and the fact that they've got the Horcrux around their neck that they don't know how to get rid of that sort of breaks down the three of them. And it was... I think it was like a thematic point because you're going to have so much action in Film 8.
Can I ask you guys a question? The one thing when we started out talking, the one thing that I didn't really get, and I don't know if I was supposed to get it or if I'm thinking too much about it, but the one thing that really didn't make any sense to me was I think they go to a place where the Hermione character says that's where she used to go camping with her father, and they're all and what's his nuts? Ron has taken off, We don't know if he's coming back. And at one point, while they're there, Harry goes walking around and he discovers the sword of Damocles.
Yep. Yeah.
And I was sort of like, well, wait, how is it the case that all of a sudden, like, they're here, and it just so happens to be the case that the sword is there. Is that something that makes sense in the book? Because in the movie, it just felt really like a convenient jump.
I'm sorry, Matt, but I just keep forgetting you haven't read the books. Trust me, there is nothing in this film that doesn't have enormous resonance in Film 8. You've just mentioned something that seems a little odd. And when I was reading the book for the first time, that seems a little odd. Trust me, that has such enormous resonance in this entire arc. That one point you just made then will actually change the entire nature of the full 8 films when you see it.
Oh, really? Wow.
It's beyond what you can imagine if you don't know what's coming. Yeah. Sorry, but that's like, I'm not going to, if you don't know that, I'm not telling you that one.
Well, I guess that's cool. I guess that's a cool thing that it stuck out as such a bizarre moment in the narrative where it was sort of, it just seems so happenstance, but that's good.
Yeah, and 1,000 people may write in and say, why didn't you just tell him? But there are enough clues when you see it in 8, you'll go back and go, oh, of course, I'm an idiot. There are things that are said and done, and you're like, if you piece together the tiny fragments of the jigsaw puzzle, you'll come up with an enormous solution. But anyway, yes, no, you are.
All right. Well.
But there's a lot of that set up for 8. Now, the question is that valid? I think it is, because I think it's almost like if you're entering Harry Potter for the first time with film 7, well, that's a pretty small audience. They're appealing to the audience that is, you know, been with these films for ages.
And they should be too, right? I mean, I think, for sure.
There's no point dumbing it down. But yes, there's a lot of that.
Okay.
So let's shift gears. I don't want to discuss plot anymore. The one thing I want to discuss is the particle animation stuff in this film. I'm a big particle animator fan, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff. We ended up, as part of the Same Stuff on FX Guy, talking to the guys at DNEG, and we were talking about particle stuff in that, and they came up with a really good point to do with what happens with a lot of the particle animation stuff, which, of course, is a simulation. So you simulate the effect. So let's assume for a second that I'm simulating water. I build a sort of digital version where I want the water to go, and you effectively pour in, depending which algorithm you're using, digital particles, and they do stuff, and then you polygonize them and render that as water. The reason I bring this up is that when you have a Dementor flying through the air at, say, 60 miles an hour, if you do a proper particle sim, you don't get swirling particles hanging around with the Dementor, because, quite frankly, they just leave them for dust, literally. Yeah. And so this is an interesting area, and I think I'd like your opinions on it, because there is no basis in fact for magic. It's obviously completely fictitious, but there is a kind of logic of the film that you either buy into or don't. And it's almost like you could say, well, that's not good magic, that's good magic, even though that's a nonsense remark. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you expect is the sort of swirly bits of the Dementors to kind of hang around with them, even though there's no reason for you to say that. And certainly from a Sims point of view, they never would want to. And it's actually what makes the particle animation really hard for the teams that do these things. So do you guys, I mean, Kanan, are you buying into what I'm saying here about this kind of weird logic that you take to the effects?
No, I do. I buy into what you're saying completely. And we've grown accustomed to things flying around in Harry Potter and leaving this sort of odd, you know, ephemera behind, where you know you see it, but you're there's no real basis in reality for the way that these particles behave. I think it works. I mean, we're dealing with a realm of magic, like you said. There's no basis in fact, although we might get 1,000 letters for saying that, by the way. but we're dealing with magic, so who knows? I mean, that's just, you know, it's consistent with the rules of the world of Harry Potter, and I think that makes perfect sense.
But it makes for difficult visual effects, because you know, I mean, you say, well, we'll just do this big particle. I mean, obviously, you're not going to hand animate particles, though. I should point out, we didn't say this. And I think it's a point worth making. I expected the discussion to swing round to Gollum when we were talking about Dobby. Unlike Gollum,
about that too.
Creature and Dobby were hand-animated by the team at Framestore. Now, I'm going to mention this because I just want to discuss this idea of hand animation. You can't hand-animate particles in the way that you could. You know, you have to use some kind of sims, and those sims become extremely difficult when they have to break every conceivable law of physics. But not only that, we do have to go back and comment on Creature and Dobby, because in a very real sense, the animation was so strong that while there was good, obviously, acting from the actor who provided the voice for Creature and Dobby, the animators at Framestore deserve so much acting accolade, I think, for the quality of the character animation on those characters. We're just remiss in not mentioning that, I think. Agreement?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there was one shot at the very beginning when we first, or one at the beginning of the film, but when we first see Dobby again for the first time, and they're standing, it might be in the kitchen, and he has a brief interaction, I believe, with, I'm going to
with
be,
Ron?
Maybe.
He shakes hands with Ron.
Well, and then there's a moment where he sort of, he reacts with a kind of almost a level of bashful shame or something, and it's sort of a beat that you know, you're not really focusing on him. He's sort of in the background, but he's in the foreground, but he's in the background in terms of the direction of the scene, in terms of where our focus is supposed to be. And he sort of recoils and cocks his head a little bit towards his right shoulder, and his eyes kind of look up, you know, as his head tilts down. And I remember, I saw that, and I remember thinking, oh man, that's just that one moment. I thought that's such great, subtle animation that conveys such a great bit of character. You know, there's so much about the character in this one very minuscule gesture that isn't really even, it's after he speaks and another character's begun to speak. I can't remember exactly who it was, but I remember that one moment in particular. And yeah, it was just, I mean, it was really, really great stuff.
I mean, Ken, I know you agree that people tend to just go, oh, it's all motion capture, and somehow that means the computers just do it. But here we have just sensational acting, all traditionally, well, I say traditionally, traditional CG, keyframed.
Yeah, you contrast this with the very first scene where they drink the polyjuice and there's a bunch of Harry Potters floating around, and you know they had 29 cameras, and you know just the sheer amount of practical camera work and everything that was required in that particular set of scenes where everyone becomes Harry Potter and the morphing. You know, you contrast that with, you know, the scene I've mentioned previously, which is where Harry's holding Dobby on the beach. You know, that was reminiscent to me of, do you remember, I know you remember this, I'm just going to say, A Children of Men, where he's holding the baby.
Mm. Yeah.
So this, that reminded me of it. I thought, oh my God, this is the same kind of, you know, believability as Children of Men. But the difference is, you know, it's not a baby, it's this creature that is clearly not a real creature.
Yeah,
it doesn't exist anywhere. Totally believable, though.
Is Harry's hand, when it's touching the face of Dobby at that last scene, is his hand real?
So I can't tell you in the individual shots. I can tell you how they did it.
It's amazing looking. I mean, it's incredible.
In the interview we did with Framestore, they had two options. They had three, I guess. They had a clean plate, but then they had a stand-in dummy, like literally a non-articulated dummy. And then they had an actor who sort of, gave them performances for eyelines and stuff.
Interesting.
As it happened, when they moved from the actor to the Dobby character, or for that matter, creature, the obviously size of the individual was not exactly the same as the size of the house elf, and so there would be bits of Harry's arm obscured, or there were problems. So there is quite a lot of work, not necessarily absolutely every shot, but quite a lot of work where most of Harry's arms and limbs are replaced or digitally altered to pull that off. So it's a very faithful performance from Daniel Radcliffe, and it's a very faithful performance in part because they tended to go for those takes when he was acting with an actor, even though those would technically not be the easiest ones to go with. And so I think, Canon, you've absolutely hit it on the head. That I had not made that link, but that is the other time that I remember being just stunned by the quality of CG interaction with an actor in Children of Men. That is a superb reference, and I think that you have to kind of do that. I don't think that was done when Ron shakes the hand of Dobby in the kitchen earlier, and I felt that while that shot worked, it was on the edge of working, and they're always difficult things to have somebody shake the hand of a digital character. But it did work, but just did at the end there, it was just magnificent. And I think that's what it really takes these days. You have to kind of keep the posture and the head, of course, the performance of someone like a Daniel Radcliffe playing Harry Potter, but then you have to go with sort of digital limbs to be able to get just the interaction. And also there's so much subtlety in the way that causes stuff to happen between the CG hand and the CG face. You know, like there's everything from sort of reflected ambience to just pressure applied and what happens with fine hair particles. There's just tons of stuff. But yeah, I think it was great. Now, can I swing the conversation back to where we started before I took us back to that character, to the particle stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Patronuses, let's talk about, say, the cat or the Patronus in the that leads him to the sword. There are fast Patronuses. We've seen that. There's an escape Patronus, which is fired, I believe, as Harry's heading for the lift as they're coming out of the Ministry of Magic. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, those fast ones, with the exception, I guess, of the training for Dumbledore's army in an earlier film, you don't tend to see the Patronuses for a lot of time because they're firing them during fights and stuff. But we definitely got some very slow shots on that cat on Umbridge's lectern, or whatever it was she was doing the interrogation, and of course in the field. What do we think? I mean, they're really quite articulated character animation, in addition to the particle effects that happen with them. Kanan?
I think they're believable. I think they look great. I'm particularly impressed with the cat, of course, but the doe or the deer that was walking along on the ice that led Arthur to the sword in the lake, Excalibur.
Just because some watery tart in a lake shoves up a sword is no basis for a system of government. No, sorry. Wrong film.
Python.
Yes.
Reference.
Yes. Yes. Arthur, yes. I'm with you.
Yes. So you have this doe, this deer, whatever, in front and center. But then in the background, you have the reflection of this particle system off of the ice. Now, the one thing I noticed, and perhaps it was because it was in this ETX, slightly more expensive, digitally projected, twice as big as 35mm theater, very bright, I noticed the reflection in the ice actually had distortion based on the density of the ice. Now, you know, because that's just the kind of thing I stare at. That is mesmerizing to me. Everyone is staring at thing in this background. There's this amazing reflection, you know, that is sharper or less sharp or what have you based on the density of the ice on the pond. And whoever did that, talk about an attention to detail.
What did we think of the Patronus that heralded the warning at the wedding at the beginning? Because interestingly, that was going to be, I'm going to say, a panther. And they decided that it would work better if it wasn't a character that turned, because normally they are animals, not a character that turned up and delivered the warning, because it would look kind of odd as talking panther. It would be comical. So it turned into more like of a loud hailer kind of, you know, warning, Will Robinson, impending doom. But it was still some jolly nice particle work. But Matt,
I thought all that stuff was great. I didn't know that it was supposed to be another animal, but it totally worked in the context.
It would have been. Sorry, I was going to say, I think it was in the script and they changed it just because they thought it would look odd. They did it in the film. It wasn't meant to be an animal.
Well, it's a Patronus, right?
Yeah.
If you look at historically Dungeons and Dragons and all of these different mythos, these Patronus, they're effectively, you know, so the entire world of J.K. Rowling is based on a lot of work that came before it. There's bags of holding, there's ogres, there's all of these things. And a Patronus is what you would typically consider in magic a familiar, which is always, it's a power animal, right? So it makes no sense that it wasn't a power animal, but I mean, I understand.
But you see what I'm saying? Like if you'd done the visual effects for that as a panther, it'd be very hard to have the panther arrive, deliver the line about warning the ministry's fallen or whatever it is, and not have that look slightly comical at a exact time when you want it to look really dramatic. I mean, it's hard to animate a talking animal when none of the Patronuses up to that point have been talking.
Yeah, but they break their own rules, too.
Yeah. I mean, I could see it going either way. I don't know that it necessarily would have looked funny, but I think, you know, you could see... I think it worked fine in the context in which they utilized it. I mean, I don't think it had to be... For me, it didn't have to be a character. I was fine that it was like... I just thought it was like some meteor message, you know, where this ball of energy came. And I imagined it being like, in my mind, I sort of filled in the holes in my knowledge of the actual narrative and with regards to the book. And I just assumed it was like some sort of, you know, warning thing that would go off at the ministry that would send off these signals to anyone and everyone who needed to know in the event of some catastrophic, you know, fall or whatever. And it was just notifying people that this is something that was about to happen and they needed to, like, you know, get their game on.
And Dean Egg did that, Patronus. Though, interestingly, the doe was done by a different house. And I'm going to say it was MPC, but I could be wrong there. And I think the other thing that's interesting is that, like, even the Death Eaters were done by different facilities. Like Rising Sun Pictures in Adelaide did the Patronuses hovering above Umbridge, and they also did the massive kind of storm of crap that's going. And I mean that in a terrifying sense when the Harry and Hermione kiss happens during the breaking of the Horcrux. Let's just discuss that, and then we're going to move on from there to discuss this idea of multiple houses doing the same kind of thing. But did we like the virtual Harry, virtual Hermione kiss and effects, Kanan?
Eh, I thought it was serviceable. I mean, it didn't take it me was, out. It, you know, it just it looked like the same kind of thing that we've seen before with the, you know, they there are several times in this film where I felt like they just kind of went, oh shit, we have to get this thing in front of people, so let's, instead of having their entire body, let's just have smoky, wispy stuff going around them so that we don't have to animate the rest of it.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there was any kind of that. This wasn't one of those rush productions. The guys on Creature and Dobby had lots of time to do their stuff. No, I mean, not okay. all the time.
I'm not saying the production itself was rushed. I'm just saying there were
But I don't think Rising Sun rushed that. I think, well, see, the thing is, they had to be fake Harry.
Then the directive was to deal wispy, smoky stuff, and it failed because... the only reason it was serviceable to me is because I just assumed, I mean, it worked, it didn't take me out of it, but I did remember consciously thinking, now why in the world is this smoke creeping up from their ankles all the way at some point to their chests to obscure the rest of their bodies? I mean, this is...
Well, they're meant to be naked, so I think there's some pretty obvious reasons why you want smoke curling up from their ankles to their chests. Matt, they were meant to be fake Harry and Hermione, so that's a difficult VFX to pull off because you want them to look real, but you don't want them to look so real. I mean, it's an Uncanny Valley problem, right? You want them to look like they're not the real ones, so the audience knows that they're fake apparitions, but not so that it looks like bad visual effects.
I mean, I thought it worked. I mean, they had that kind of real, you know, shiny, plasticky kind of sheen to their skin that made them look real... sort of otherworldly, and I thought even prior to their appearance that the is it all smoke? I was under the impression that some of that material that comes up out of the necklace was like it was like a lot of mud and fluid and
or was that's why I call it crap. It's like evil
stuff. I thought that was really before they appeared. I actually thought that thing, whatever it was really it was fascinating to look at. It really
absolutely.
I found it really arresting visually. I really enjoyed that a lot. And I didn't have any problem. I mean, it's sort of embarrassing to admit, but I mean, I noticed the smoke too, Kanan, that you're talking about, that it was just so conveniently placed, you know? And I guess that's sort of, you know, as a male audience member, you know, you're sort of looking and you're watching that and you're like, oh, you know, it's sort of mildly titillating or whatever. But then
it's Hermione. What are you talking about?
Hey, you know, I'm
parent.
I'm just saying.
You're a parent.
This is movie 7, man. We've moved on. Like, I thought it worked. It didn't take me out of it at all. I thought it was really successful. And the other particle thing I wanted to just ask you guys about, because I actually had a few problems with it, was the scene in the I think it's in the Ministry of Magic, right, where all the papers are flying around.
Mm-hmm.
And there was.
The chase scene where the papers are flying and they sort of attach themselves to
a couple people. Yeah, get covered with paper. And I thought that was actually. I mean, you know, I'm game, and I'm with you, Mike. Like, I'm a big fan of any and all particle effects. Like, that's something that really gets me going. I love seeing that stuff, and I think it was really successful, as you guys were saying, with the dough, the Patronus. That was probably my favorite thing in the whole film. It was just totally beautiful, but the papers flying around, that was problematic. I thought that looked a little bit tough. Like it didn't look right. There was something about it that looked wrong when it started to stick to the characters. I don't know if you would concur, Kanan, or if you had any if you could bolster that argument. Anyway, I'm not sure exactly why it looked funny, but there was something about that looked wrong to me.
You know what it looked like? It looked like, imagine if you took a fruit roll-up and threw it and it stuck to someone.
So it's that it didn't look like paper, maybe.
Yeah,
I completely agree with you. I think I actually remember that there was the second last shot in that sequence, and the, I call the last shot where he sort of breaks three of the paper. Mm. I literally sort of went to myself, huh, what? And I don't know what the huh, what was referring to, because moving at the speed that that chase was happening, I didn't really have time to process it. But there was definitely something that felt like it wasn't either, maybe you're right, Cannon, it wasn't that it was no longer paper, or that it was, I guess it was meant to be directed paper by the nature of the charm that he, or the spell that he threw. But yeah, there was a point there where I went, huh, what? And I can't articulate what it was. I must wait till I see it again before I can pay attention to that. But yeah, that, I had forgotten that. It was definitely a slightly jarring, not you know, ghastly, not horrible, not how did that get past Q&A, but just it's something seemed odd. It could have been, I actually thought it was a cut, just an editorial cut, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was.
So the Hermione and the Harry in the mud thing, the mud tornado, they're totally digital?
No, they shot the actors on green screen, and then they treated them.
Gotcha.
And yeah. So let's get back to this bigger issue just in finishing up. I want to just discuss this idea of a collaborative effort, because I think it'd be pretty safe to say that not only is this film creatively delivered sort of tremendous joy to so many people, it's obviously done phenomenal box office, but for me personally, it's been a triumph of collaboration, because we've got, in this case, we've been discussing Framestore, Rising Sun, DNEG, MPC, there's like a lot, I think, CineSite. So there's a lot of the London facilities. There's people outside that. I think we've also discussed Sony in this issue. Obviously, ILM has contributed to the Potter franchise. There's a lot of companies that have contributed. We're getting, with the exception of that Evolution thing we discussed, we're getting very consistent looks from a huge number of facilities. And I've been pushing that, you know, to make it viable these days, we really ought to go down the route of having one major facility handling a film. But I've got to say, the fact that you can have in the one film major distinctive effects, like the Patronus is done by two different companies, that the Death Eater is done by multiple companies, and they all kind of work, and everybody shares assets and makes the deadlines and does such good work.
I think that's a credit certainly to all the houses, to all the visual effects supervisors, all the members of all the teams at all those places. But I also think it's really important to recognize and make note of the fact that there are art directors and there are visual effects art directors too that work on these projects directly for the studio, for the production, and they're, you know, generating enormous amounts of work. You know, big 11x17, you know, digital prints that they are mocking up the looks for things and doing keyframes and delivering those, I think, probably across the board to all the various houses that are working on these shows. And I think the work that the visual effects art directors are doing in conjunction with the art directors and the concept designers and the directors, I mean, I think that stuff is really pivotal. I know, you know, for me in my professional experience working at different places, if I have some reference material that's been generated by an art director, everyone has something visual to start with, to look at, and we can all sit down and at least, you know, have a frame of reference, literally a frame of reference for conversation, right? For a jumping off point as to where we go from there. And I think that's something that is really key. And I don't, you know, I don't know who the art directors were on the show, but
the art department was extensive. The production designer was Stuart Craig, I believe. Mm-hmm. There was quite a bunch of art directors. I think the senior art director was Andrew Auckland Snow. That could be wrong. I could check that up. But I think the visual effects supervisor of the film and the visual effects supervisors for the individual facilities are to be commended, because I don't know. But I mean, you just can't have a bitchy environment. You have to have a really good, creative, collaborative environment. And from hearing the stories both on and off the record from the facilities and the individuals that worked on them, there was tremendous faith given, you know, that this is what we want Creature to look like, and Dobby, okay, go do it now and have a small team and work on it for 6 months, and we're not going to, you know, as they, pardon my French, pardon my swearing, we're not going to pixel fuck with it and just fuss on individual things. And I think that's tremendously, I think that the cinematography, as we've already mentioned, was really good. I'm blanking on the cinematographer's name. It was
Mendez, I believe it is. Let's see if I can. Eduardo Serra.
No, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
And I think that was great. There are a lot of funny anecdotes in the sort of trivia about this film that I think are kind of funny. I think when they're running through the forest at one point, I don't know if you guys heard this, but the director, the three actors have to, heroes have to run away, and they've got these guys meant to be running after them, and they're all set up to do this shot, and they thought, well, we'll give them one just to kind of get their legs, and then we'll, really make them push for it on two. And they set action on the first one, and the three actors just took off in a race with each other through the woods and just completely left A unit behind and the people that were meant to be catching them. And it was suddenly like, okay, we're going to kind of need to we got some young athletic actors here. We're going to have to really, get going. And I love the production art department stuff. The fact they had to make 500 wands just for this film alone is just, I think, hysterical.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's just a tremendous collaborative effort between the units, which I think is sensational. And it's really moved, rightfully, I believe, to the London facilities to sort of carry the weight of these. Where,
yeah, and haven't the London, those main London shops too, don't they kind of have a – they've developed kind of a history of being able to work together in this way.
Together,
I know. Yeah, and really I think well. I remember hearing Paul Franklin talk about that at one time.
Yeah, and they work together, and they, you just never hear them saying a bad word about each other. And I think that's really, really impressive. I think you need to have that kind of depth. And I know there are tax reasons for moving stuff around the world, and I know there's a lot of political reasons for moving stuff around the world, but it is kind of nice for something that's so quintessentially English that the English houses get to work on them. And
Seems really appropriate that way. Yeah.
Just a couple of points. Last time we talked about Harry Potter, I think we mentioned that Maggie Smith had just had breast cancer when she was doing her role as one of the heads of house, and she looked pretty bad in that. And she wasn't in this one, but apparently she's coming back for the second one. And I certainly hope that the actress is much better, and I certainly love her character and look forward to seeing her in the next film. I think the next film is going to be quite simply spectacular. The only real thing that... we've seen, I think, for the next film is the shot of Hogwarts burning. It's on the posters and some of the PR that they put out.
Right.
But clearly there are a couple of really big, big scenes that are left in the book. For those of you know, there's a huge bank robbery as well as the massive fight at the end. And it should be really good. They've got, obviously, that in production now because that film comes out in 6 months' time. But for a film that's on its eighth outing... no way does it feel like it's the eighth, sequel. I mean, that Star Wars should produce two more films and their seventh and eighth would be, stand up this well. I just can't imagine us discussing a seventh and eighth Star Wars film right now and having the same kind of gushing feeling about them. And maybe that's no disrespect to ILM, but just to the filmmakers who are managing the franchise. But, yeah, Warner Brothers is to be congratulated because it has been, obviously, very carefully carried through. Is there anything else you wanted to discuss that I haven't touched on? I guess we've, I think, hit most of the main beats of the film. There is one huge thing we haven't discussed. I'm sorry. Go on.
I was going to say, I would like to, if it's all right, I'd like to just briefly mention the 3-plus-minute frame store animated sequence.
That's what I was about to mention as well.
That's good, good.
Yeah. So please, lead off on that.
Well, there's a 3-plus-minute animated sequence about the Deathly Hallows done by Framestore, which is just spectacular. I mean, good grief. Like there, I can't say enough good things about it. I mean, it was just everything about it was so well executed. It looked great. It was very viscerally pleasing to me. Felt a little bit like a puppet show. It reminded me slightly of the story told in Hellboy. Do you remember the when they told the story of Hellboy? I guess that it was in Hellboy 2.
I'm not a big Hellboy guy. Go on.
I can't remember which Hellboy. If you recall, Mark Christensen and I did a Hellboy/Hancock VFX show, which we lovingly titled Hellcock. So I'm not a big fan either, but But it did remind me of that a little bit. It was like, it once again, like the Children of Men, you know, story. It was this thing where I saw it in Hellboy, and I remember thinking, God, this, yeah, it kind of sucks, but it could be better, you know. And this was just executed perfectly, in my opinion.
Totally agree.
Did you know that the Swiss director, Ben Hibben, I think it is, Hibben? Yeah, who directed that, immediately got the role to direct the dark version, as it were, of Peter Pan, called Pan. Like, his work was so spectacular that they signed him to direct that feature, which apparently Del Toro was possibly going to direct. But after they saw the Deathly Hallows sequence, he got the directing gig on that, and... I don't know. We need another Pan film, but if he's going to do it, I'd be happy to, you know, put up my $12 and go see it. Because I agree, it's a really amazing piece, and it's also for me a really interesting sort of cinematic device, because that lets stop the film and have a piece of exposition, which, as I heard earlier in the show, I refer to as the 1984 book sequence, because in the original 1984, the book's going along quite happily, and then it just stops and they start reading from a book inside the book, which just explains, you know, huge amounts of the world, and then you sort of come back to the story again. And in that particular case, I was like, George Orwell, you have forsaken us for exposition, though it was, of course, you know, immensely culturally significant. I didn't actually get that same sensation with this. I didn't get like, hang on a second, we've just got to sit through a whole bunch of boring exposition now. But it could have been that, don't you think, Matt? I mean, it could have been. Heck?
It could have been, you know, but it was funny when I felt like the movie kind of came to a stop in a way when they started that sequence. However, I was conscious of that sequence, maybe only in part because the story that you did about it, that FX Guide did about it on the animation. So I was really conscious of it, but I stopped for just a minute and I kind of took my eyes off the screen and looked around the theater. And it was amazing how her telling that story in conjunction with those visuals, like, it took no one out of the story. If anything, everyone in the theater that I was in, they were immediately like drawn further into the narrative, you know, like it had exactly the kind of effect that you'd want it to have. I think in part because of the visuals, but also just it was a really neat individual kind of, and I, you know, this is often used as a derogatory word, but a set piece within the film that worked amazingly well. And it was just, it was neat. It was neat how, captivating it was for people. And I have to say, it made me think, not having read the book, so are the last three Horcruxes the wand, the stone, and the cloak of invisibility?
Okay, so I'm not going to answer that other than to say, if you really think that the film is that obvious, then you're going to...
Then I'm totally... Okay, good.
The style, that sort of shadow puppet style, I believe was an Eastern, I know it was a reference to sort of Eastern animation style. And yeah. I think, look, it's interesting because mainly, I guess, because of the success of both Disney and Pixar, we're kind of used to a certain style of animation, especially when it comes to computers and stuff. And we don't, you know, tend to get a huge amount of very, very, very stylistic animation. We do get, obviously, Tim Burton stuff. Cannon, I mean, were you just as impressed with this in terms of execution and as the styling of it? Because it was very original.
I loved everything about it. Execution, styling, story, how it was told, how it looked, everything.
We've got like three sample frames from that. That's in the story that Matt was referring to. If you want to click on those for a larger version, you can get to sort of see them in a bit of detail. And there is a lovely filmic quality to them. Obviously, they're very sepia. But yeah, it's an interesting sequence. I wonder how long you could hold that up for. Do you think it would have got boring if it had continued for much longer, or do you feel it was just, you were just happy with it?
I think it was just about right. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that there was more of that narrative to tell. I mean, it seemed like it didn't get boring at all, I don't think. It's hard to say. I mean, I think, you know, you could try to make a feature, you know, maybe not a 2.5 hour feature, but it might be interesting to see a feature film made that was maybe, you know, 70 or 80 minutes in length.
Yeah, I would definitely watch something like that. I mean, we've seen Coraline and we've seen The Nightmare Before Christmas and these other films. And so we're certainly used to this extraordinarily stylized method of
it's exciting
to
see
giving us content.
It's exciting to see like computer generated imagery like breaking with kind of what we've just become accustomed to, sort of breaking with visual traditional cinema language and doing what you know you could do, which is something just totally, you know, mind-blowingly experimental and visually, you know, really bold and daring. And I think seeing stuff like that is really, for me, that's just really exciting. I love it when something like that breaks with the tradition, with what we're used to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, Maya stuff with ZBrush, of course, and it was using Ncloth and rendered in RenderMan. It's not like they had, you know, a brand new app or something that that they were applying to it. It was just, I think, you know, just very well done by a really interesting director and a really interesting team. Because, you know, obviously director's terrific, but, I think the team at Framestore, if you consider that this is running in parallel to the Dolby stuff we've been raving about, I'd have to say that... you know, Framestore hash win on this one. So,
yeah, they couldn't be more different in terms of the finish, right? But in terms of the quality, is just stellar on both counts.
Yeah, take nothing away from the other companies, but you just have to say that if you were in the animation department of Framestore right now, you should be feeling damn proud, and rightfully so, I think. All right, well, let's finish off this. We want to thank Todd and Matt, our producers on the show, who do a great job, and quite frankly, to quote Ron Reasley, we wouldn't last 2 days without them. I want to thank you guys for being on the show. Kanan, where can we find you if somebody wants to check out? You've started doing your podcast again, I believe.
I have. If you point your browser at lifezero.org, you'll see a myriad of links, one of which is to the Life Zero podcast, which is back up and running. And the other one is, in fact, I'm releasing one this week. And the other one is to That Post Show, which I was fortunate enough to do an episode with Kinji Kato, John, and Michael Kritz on this last one. I don't know if you've heard it, but a little bit of a departure, very technical, lots of fun.
And Matt, you have nothing to fear. If you have nothing to hide, where are you?
MattWallen.com is where you can find me. And yeah, thanks again.
And just before we go, I just want to, Kanan, I don't know what you're like, but I know John Montgomery is a huge Tron fan, and that's coming out very soon, and we'll be having a VFX show on that. I've seen bits of it. I think I've seen about 23 minutes of it now, so it's looking good, but I'm looking forward to seeing the whole thing, and hopefully it'll be spectacular. But so there's some really interesting visual effects work coming up in that with Benjamin Button level visual effects stuff. So anyway, that all coming up in a future show. You can find us, of course, over at fxguide.com and me personally at Twitter as Mike Seymour. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you guys next time. Thanks so much. Bye.